Welcome back to Open Mind. I'm Keith Barry, and today we're diving into the mind of Frank Deegan. Frank is an Irish survivalist who spent over a decade preparing for the worst case scenarios most of us, well, we avoid thinking about. From bunkers and stockpiles to his work as a community first responder, Frank's life is built on resilience, readiness, and lessons we can all learn. Frank, you're very welcome to Open Mind.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first of all, I just found out you're a Daisha man like myself. Born and bred in Waterford.
Well, born in the hospital there in Arkeen back in the day. Yeah, lived in Ross in Rossbirkin, so just down the road.
So tell us, when did you first get interested in survivalism?
As I was saying to you earlier, when I was younger, I built a canoe when I was 14 years of age. It was a timber frame boat and finished it off with canvas, which was painted then and hardened, you know, made it water resistant. That was great. And I decided one day, right, see you, ma'am, I'm off. Where are you going? St. Mullins, 12 miles up the river on the main river Barrow. So packed a few tins of beans, a few fire lighters, lighter, and sleep bag in a tent, and off I went. I came back 2 days later and I was like drowned as a rat.
and your mother was like...
Oh, she was paranoid. She lost the plot altogether. But this, that was my kind of introduction to outdoors and stuff. And then the Rambo movies came along.
Now, oh, yeah.
This is back in the 70s, early 80s, this would have been.
Yeah.
So, everybody like myself, we all got the Rambo knives with the fishing kit inside the little compass and all that. We thought, this is it, great. I'm going to have to survive. See you, ma'am.
Yeah.
Going to have to catch a deer with my knife. Got nothing at all, but sure. Yeah. God loves a trier. So, years later then, I joined the Navy, the Merchant Navy. And in the course of my qualifications within the Navy then, we had to do survival, sea survival, and kind of miniature survival stuff, not compared to what we do now.
Yeah.
But it was years later that I got back into it again, because I used to have a boat down Dunmore East, a sailboat.
Mm.
So we used to go off on long trips and we'd have to store our food and we'd be able to catch food and cook them and stuff. And all of the survivalist stuff kind of all came together years later then when I think the last recession kicked in around 2008 or so.
Okay.
Between 2008, 2012, I think I really got back into it again. I was outdoors more often. I was going off hiking and fishing and camping with my wife. And then I had a YouTube channel and I started up a YouTube channel. Within a week, I had 80 followers. And then I met one or two lads from down Cork direction. And can we go out camping with you?
Yeah.
Come on, lads, let's go. And next thing, we started up the Irish Survivalist Group. So we were doing a lot of bushcraft.
Yeah.
So cooking in the ground, catching rabbits. Are you able to catch rabbits?
I am. I know how to catch rabbits. I'd like to think of myself as a survivalist. I'm not quite at your level, obviously, but listen, when I was young, it was all about fishing, lighting your own fires. And yes, I've caught a couple of rabbits in snares. I've also shot a few rabbits. I know how to skin a rabbit. My uncle Damien, who's probably listening to this podcast down in Kenmare,
how are you, Damien?
Well, Damien lives off the land quite a lot now, right? And he taught me to skin a rabbit. So, yeah, I know exactly how to skin a rabbit, how to cook a rabbit.
Can you do it without a knife? That's the question.
I'll do it with my teeth. I mean, I know my way was to cut around the paws. So you cut around the ankles. I remember it well. Cut around the ankles of the four paws, then give it a nick in its neck. And then you snap off the four paws. Then you peel it like a banana and then you lop off its head and then that's it, done. So that's
mine is a bit more gruesome, I'm afraid, without a knife. But when you have the rabbit and he's dead, you grab him by the head and you squeeze down on the neck.
Yeah.
Then you get him onto your knee and it will huge push. His whole innards will come out his backside.
Okay.
It does actually work.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I've seen lads shooting and they're doing it as they're walking along.
Right.
Done. And then they strip the skin and off you go. Into the pouch.
Well, there you go. If you're without a knife, that's the way to skin a rabbit.
It works really fast.
But come here, let's go back for a second. I'm telling you now, kids these days have it easy, right? They got YouTube. So if they want to learn how to make a canoe out of anything, they would just type in, make a canoe out of plastic, make a canoe out of a tree, make a canoe out of whatever, right? How did you figure out how to make a canoe?
Back in the day, I was in the CBS and then I transferred over to the regional college or the tech where they did woodwork and metalwork.
Yeah, okay.
And I found a book inside the class on how to make a canoe.
Okay.
Brought home anyway and I did it on my own. But I built it down in the boat club in New Ross.
Yeah.
And they were getting out to me because I used to store it there as well and it was always in the way. And this is a fairly big canoe, like it's probably 13 or 14 feet.
Right.
So it's fairly sizable and I built it and it was like built in out of fretwood, very light.
Yeah.
And I was just following the instructions on the book, and everybody's amazed I did it, and I was amazed myself. I was amazed it actually floated.
Yeah.
But it did actually carry two people.
Right.
And a lot of equipment inside it. So.
And that first trip, did you go on? You went on your own.
Very first trip. Well, obviously I did a few trials in and around the boatyard and whatever, but the very first trip I went on my own because nobody else had a canoe. That was it.
Were you scared at all?
No.
At that age?
No, I kept
no
to the
fear.
Bank. I was well able to swim, but I mean, swimming in that river and it's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah.
We learned to swim in that river and we learned to swim in the pool in New Ross as well. So, but we actually swam in that river down to the bridge and back up again.
Okay.
Can you believe that?
Right.
I was always a good swimmer. And over the years then, I got into scuba diving. It was 30 years diving.
Right.
Myself, the brother, and giant clubs and went off the hook and water for tobacco and all of them. Do you ever try that?
I haven't dived. Well, sorry, I have. I dived once. Do you want to hear my diving story real quick? Right. So my diving story is this. I was in Cancun, New Mexico. It was 2003. Shot a TV show down there. Long story short, I stayed an extra couple of days and I went on a scuba diving course. But the scuba diving course in Cancun, Mexico, the scuba diving course was into a swimming pool for an hour, tank on your back, and a Mexican lad just kind of teaching you the signs. And then out we went on a boat. It was really rough. Went out in a boat and we went on a dive. So we were down, we'll just say 10 metres, right? But it was really rough. So we were getting swayed all over the place underneath the water and I started to feel really sick. And I remembered at the time the sick kind of symbol that you had to say to the lad. So I did this. But he hadn't taught us how to puke into the regulators, what you call
it. Nice.
And I didn't know what to do. So he just pointed back at the rope, which was a considerable distance away. And I pull up the rope and I'm going up quite fast. And then I start thinking, not knowing enough about it, am I going to get the bends at this depth? And I don't know. But I got up and I pulled it out and I started puking blood everywhere. And I'm crying and I'm like, oh my God, I think I'm going to die. And no one knows,
here.
Anyway, your man pulled me up and on. And then I just started laughing. And he's like, oh my God, you're puking blood. And I said, no, I just realised I'd had a Bloody Mary before I went out because I was hungover from the night before. So it wasn't blood at all. So not to be recommended. No alcohol before you go scuba diving. So that was my only scuba. I do a lot of snorkeling. I do a huge amount of snorkeling.
You really should have got back into it. Like the Waterford, in fairness, has a great scuba club.
Yeah. No, it's something that, I am a complete and utter at heart hunter-gatherer. So for me, when I'm scuba diving, I'm always trying to get down to grab a crab or whatever. And then I always love the idea, I reckon probably next year I'll eventually get to it, of spearfishing.
It's extremely addictive when you get into the scuba.
Yeah, spearfishing, that'll be my thing.
Yeah.
So, and I like the idea. I can hold my breath for considerable length of time, up to my personal breath is 3¾ minutes.
Okay.
So I can go underwater for a long time. Yeah. But enough about me. Like, tell us, like, you're an engineer by profession. How do you balance kind of the normal day job with what some people might think is an extreme hobby or an extreme lifestyle? How do you find that balance?
Well, I know my manager always looks at me and he thinks I'm cracked half the time when I'm telling him I'm taking off a few days to go off camping and stuff. I just look forward to the peace and quiet. Like, we were only there on Friday to Sunday gone. And there was about 9 of us out there, 9 or 10. And there was strangers passing by. They were out on a walk on the weekend and they were looking at our setup. They said, wow.
So hang on, stop. So imagine you're one of those strangers.
Yes.
Describe your setup. What are they seeing?
Okay, I see one guy in a Kerry top, Tipperary top coming by him, and I could hear him comment to one of the girls with him. There's a group of about 15 of them. I give 10 grand to be with them lads now. And I heard one of the lads at us, here, you can do it for 1,000.
Yeah.
But what he saw was, I have what's called a lay flat hammock. It's basically a hammock that you can turn and roll in and the hammock won't budge.
Okay.
Okay. Whereas traditional ones are hanging between two trees. Mine hangs between two trees, but they're anchored off.
Okay.
And it's only a new purchase I got in the last couple of years, but I've only used it a few times. So they saw that with a tarp and the tarp was completely come out.
Yep.
So really blended in. We blended in really well.
Yeah.
Mine was perfect. We blended in. Paul from Mayo, his was the very same. He's an old type one, but blended in.
Yeah.
The other twat there behind us, Kevin, hello. He had a white tent on the ground and a bit of seats, a bit of mess around him, you know, and they were looking and saying, for a second, you'd forgive him for saying there's a homeless guy sitting over there, but he wasn't. Snoring his head off because his tent was a blackout one.
Okay.
He'd stay up all night and he'd stay in the bed all day.
Yeah.
So that's his thing. He gets away for the weekend. He said he loves it. That's his peace and quiet, you know. And the whole experience for us is really to catch up with each other.
Yeah.
Have a chat, sit around the fire, an open fire, have a few beers watch the day go by or the night go by and follow the stars and whatever. And of course, over the years, we've been discussing different topics as well. So we could do cooking venison in the ground. That's okay. One we used to do for cameras regularly. Now, I tried it with a big deer, a full deer the last time.
Right.
Paul, the same guy from Mayo, brought down the deer that he shot 2 weeks earlier and it had it frozen.
Wow.
He forgot to defrost the deer. We were in the ground for hours and the cameras were looking
starving.
And we opened it up and the thing wasn't doing anything at all. Poked it. It's still frozen.
Right. Yeah.
So we cut off a leg and we made a stew.
Okay.
And it has to be said, it is one of the best stews that has ever been created on planet Earth, because everybody, even at this last camp, was talking about the stew that we did. It was amazing because it was par cooked and then stewed.
Yeah.
And we did it in a big cast iron skillet.
Yeah.
And I mean, you just can't beat that kind of stuff.
And where were you last weekend? Where you were there with your camouflage camps. We got Kevin with his white tent. Where were you? Where these people were they were walking past and they spotted you. Where
down
were you?
In Glengarra, County Tipperary.
Okay.
And it's part of the Galty Mountains group. And it was absolutely fantastic. We that was where we actually first all met as a group in Glengarra. Not what I was saying when the first YouTube video went out.
Yep.
That was down in West Cork somewhere.
Okay.
Glengarra was our kind of go-to place because it's in the centre of Ireland and there's a motorway running 10 miles away, so it's very easy access for all of us.
Yeah. And would you get out every week to do this? Or
Jesus Christ, no. The days are going out every week. I well gone. My job is full on. Like I work 5 or 6 days a week.
Okay.
So I come home and I'm exhausted and then you have to go out work in the end. You know.
A lot of people, they hear the word prepper or survivalist and they think like conspiracy theorists, they think doomsday scenarios. Like, what is your definition of kind of what you do? Is it prepper? Is it survivalist?
Well, I'd start with a prepper first. A prepper is somebody who's prepared for an emergency or catastrophe or something that we don't plan on, like a major storm or a major weather event, snow, hurricane, whatever.
Yeah.
Like we did last year, half of Ireland was without electricity for a prolonged period of time,
yeah.
But Dublin evaded it, so you didn't get to witness the hardship that they had up there.
Yeah.
I went up there with my company and I was working from a hotel.
Okay.
And I saw it firsthand. One guy, he was quadriplegic in a wheelchair. He said he couldn't charge his wheelchair for 11 days. They tried it in the car and the car wasn't capable of doing it.
Right.
But after I got there, the electric was only on 2 days later, but he was stuck in his house for 11 days. That kind of drives it home.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, a prepared person would have maybe a generator, me.
Yeah.
I have solar panels myself and big batteries up in the attic. The batteries are very expensive, so about $4,000 worth of batteries up there. And I can plug into them. They also send off to the grid as well, so you're making a few quid a year, not much.
Yeah.
To be honest, they're cutting back on it even.
Right.
So the generator would go and would run the fridges in the house or the freezers, whatever you have. Also, I wouldn't have a huge amount of food. Maybe 30 days worth of food or maybe 3 months. I would say go to 3 months because that's generally what I used to keep. Water as well. Water is an important one because we lose it the whole time out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got an electric oven, gas hob, because when the electric is gone, gas will work. The water's turned off when the electric goes off, so
it's
the water and the pipes keep breaking. They only broke again last week. So the survivalist part of it is when you run out of all of them options and you can't. Say you're 10 feet of snow dumped in your backyard overnight and you can't get out. And you're living out in the sticks.
Yeah.
You're okay in the city, more or less. But then again, it's the city then is on-demand shopping, if you know what I mean.
They,
it's 24 hours and you'll have a lorry coming in and replenish the shop. That lorry can't get in there. Them shops, the shelves are going to be empty very fast. So survival part of it would be to be able to know, like mushrooms, say, for example, or meats or vegetables or something that you can eat, that you can identify and that you can prepare and cook. So it's basically what we're doing is rewilding ourselves to our ancestors, our great-great-great-grandparents. They didn't have fridges or electric. So you got to figure out how did they survive the winter.
Yeah.
They didn't have a shop to run to, that's for damn sure. So what did they eat? What did they cook? How did they manage it? You know? All of that kind of stuff is what we relearned and we'd be teaching amongst ourselves at some online classes there as well, or online videos and whatever.
And besides like the obvious, which is like what you just mentioned, like a severe weather event, maybe shutting the country down, maybe taking electricity away. Are there other things?
A red alert in the country shuts it down.
Okay.
But a red alert, we've never had 3 or 4 days of a red alert.
Yeah.
Where you can't, you're not allowed to drive because, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Is there other things that concern you? Like, is there wars and things like that? Or?
Okay, well, if you want to move on to the... I was asked about... What do I think?
How far are you prepping for?
Oh, well, look, we have I got in trouble the last time I mentioned the bunker. We have a main bunker and it's about 150 people can get into it, okay? And it's not purpose-built. The second bunker I have is very close to where I live and is extremely well done and it can be converted really quick.
How do we get on the list to get in the big bunker?
That is, you know...
Can I get on the list?
There's a lot of people ask me, can I get on the list? And I said, well, look, you gotta be in the club or we have to be vetted. Everybody vets people coming in. We don't want people that won't shut up, like, you know.
Yeah. But tell me this, right? So the other one, so it's obviously your own personal bunker, is it?
No. I would if I had the money.
So you've got one big one.
We've got one big one.
And then the other one takes how many people-ish?
The other one will take about 20.
20, okay.
But do you want all that 20 in there because it's a little tight of a space.
So how many of you are involved or were involved in the build of that?
No, that's once. Built. That is built and it's built in 1991, yeah.
So you didn't build it?
No, I didn't, no.
Okay, all right. So
I have access to it.
Yeah.
It's not mine, I have access to it. I've also got access to one up in Mullingar, which we haven't spoken for a long time. So the guy that owns that owns a lot of land as well and he built his own one, but... I think he may be a bit eccentric. I'm not sure.
How many of these? Well, yeah, I think you have to be eccentric to own your own survivalist bunker.
If I had the money, I'd build one.
No, but how many do you estimate are in the country?
Bunkers? Well, the government built them back in the 80s as well. Don't forget that.
For themselves
when Cold War was going on, 60s to the 80s.
Okay.
One is in Athlone in the army barracks in Athlone.
Right.
And they did a documentary on it lately and you see all the different rooms and the comms rooms and whatever. Basically, we're never going to get hit by a nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
We're not going to get one landed on us in Dublin.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Belfast, maybe. Liverpool, Bristol, all of the main channels, all that area, they're going to get pounded and we're going to get the irradiated fallout. That's the danger part.
Okay.
If we get that, you're not going to be leaving your house for about a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. Not for a few months, but I'm just saying a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
They've downgraded to a few weeks because... The radiation degrades fast.
Yeah.
Depending on the bomb. That we don't know what bomb it is, but there was mention of a bomb called a cobalt bomb, which is a really nasty piece of work.
Okay.
It'll keep radiated for 10, 20 years.
Right.
So you won't be able to get it for 10 or 20 years.
Jesus.
That'll be a no-no. You might as well just give up the ghost.
Well, that's it. Yeah. So for people listening out there, right, I think this might be a bit extreme. And when I listen to it, actually... And I'm one of these real critical thinkers, right? Yeah. It doesn't sound that extreme to me what you're doing.
It's not outside
of
the realm of possibility. If Putin goes cracked and he says, right, Germany, I'm going to nuke you and I drop one on France and Germany or England just for the laugh. Like, he's capable of doing it.
Yeah.
He's done great.
Well, I think the way the world has gone now, I think we know that these, I suppose, larger countries, dictators, these, like, I think they are capable of some very unusual decisions. Let's put it that way. So... for people out there who are listening, right, we'll have two cohorts listening right now. They'll think, Frank is crazy.
Or I have something.
And Keith's crazy to even be entertaining it. And I'm not. I actually, I'm definitely at heart a survivalist, an outdoors person, a hunter-gatherer. And then there's other people who are going to go, where do we start? Right. So if there's somebody out there who's thinking, geez, I've never thought about this before. I've never thought about the fact that, you know, like, not only could it be without electricity for a prolonged period of time, but actually, if we get a big slap of snow or something and I'm completely shut down, food can't get in, what's the first go-to? How do people start?
Depending on your location, like I said, if you're in a major capital city, there'll be a run on the shops for food like there was during the storm.
Yeah.
And they clean them out very fast.
Yeah.
I sometimes ask people, customers, when I'm in their houses, and I'll say to them, if you had 10 feet of snow outside the door, what do you have in this house right now, this second? How much food have you got here? And the answer I'm getting back is 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
2 or 3 days will last. You can make that last to 5 or 6 days, I'm sure. I don't know. I could never say 2 or 3 days in my house because I know I have months' worth.
What does that look like then? How do you have months' worth? Because obviously you don't have... months of fresh vegetables in the fridge.
So is it
tins of beans and tins? So give us your top tips.
Freeze-dried and dehydrated food. Pot noodle.
Okay.
That's a great example. Yeah, that's all freeze-dried and you just add water and it regenerates it.
Okay.
And all you see the little flakes in there as well. There's little carrots and little bits of vegetables. They all rehydrate.
Okay.
That's extremely low, light in weight.
Yeah.
So, and size wise. I've got dehydrated food in freezer bags with oxygen absorbers.
Okay.
And in a dark area. So there's a big pile of it in my house. I have one room. It's not overwhelming or anything, but...
But hang on, is this one here... Like, cause people out there are listening. So, like, let's imagine we've got a four-bedroom house. What are we doing? Are we taking away one of the bedrooms?
Yeah, I have a...
I suppose people can just chuck it up in their attic, right?
Not necessarily.
No.
Because you get heat in the summer and cold in winter. So
it needs to be in a room in the house.
The room in the house is generally, there's no heater in this room.
Okay.
It's an outdoor laundrette that we have.
Okay.
And it's indoors, but it's outdoor. It's just, there's no heating and it's darkish. There's no, just two lights in the place.
Yeah.
But it's perfect for us, for storing the food.
Yeah. So what else? We got the noodles. What else is your
Well, I have spaghetti will last forever, and beans, not necessarily tinned beans. We have the kidney beans and the white beans.
Okay.
The chickpeas. They're great in protons as well, or calcium, or you name it.
Yeah.
Any kind of food.
No, but they're highly nutritious. Extremely foods is what
nutritious,
you're saying.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It'll give you exactly what you need to get you through the day energy-wise.
Yeah.
Dried meats. That's one you might even have seen in the shops. You can buy jerky, beef jerky.
Yeah, yeah.
You see it sometimes in Aldi, Lidl, and you come out. They have them in there. We've done that a few times with venison. We just dried them, and smoked them under a fire, in a fire, and you cover the fire like a tent.
Yeah.
And you, depending on the wood that you use, it gives that flavor
different
out to
flavors,
it. Which is brilliant. That's you got to try that one when you're fishing.
Yeah.
You also can do it when you're doing with mackerel or pollock.
Yeah.
Dry the fish.
Yeah.
That'll last for a good while as well.
Yeah.
So all of that kind of stuff, it's the bulk. It's the bulk amount of it that you have. And then, like, if you go on to any of the survival sites, you'll see that there's foods out there which are freeze-dried.
Mm-hmm.
These are ones, and I wanted to get one of these machines. And they're about $3,000, $4,000.
Okay.
Very expensive. And if you want to go down that line, which I don't think I want to try, but I've had a friend of mine, Mick Daniels, down in Waterford.
Okay, yeah.
You know Mick? He got one and he said, never again, I'm getting one of them bloody machines, because the thing just blew up, mate. It's an American.
Breaks all the time, yeah.
He couldn't get the parts to fix it. So
what is freeze dried then? What happens there?
It was designed by NASA to bring food up to space, into space at the lightest weight. So it takes the weight off, freezes it down to minus 40. And as it's coming back up again, the water vapors are taken out of it. So it's completely good.
Yeah.
25 years is the shelf life.
You're reminding me of something. So for people listening, just so everybody knows, for the crack one time, I bought astronaut food off of, I think it was Amazon. So you can actually get this free. So I know exactly what you're talking about. You can get this freeze-dried food. I got freeze-dried strawberries.
But you can get ice cream as well.
Yeah. So you can actually, you don't have to do this yourself. You can actually go online and buy this freeze-dried food.
It is twice the price of stuff. Yeah, so as I'm saying, it is possible to buy it. I have a load of it at home. Actually, do you know, I didn't bring it this weekend. We brought MREs this weekend, meals ready to eat.
Okay.
All Irish Army stuff. So that's all we were on this weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
Bar the steaks.
What does that taste like?
Bar the chicken. Bar the beer.
There you go.
Bar the noodles.
He's prepped and ready to survive on steaks, beer.
If you have it, you know, you don't have to live like a pauper either.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the meals ready to eat are designed for the army guys. So it's actually German, made in Germany.
What do they taste like?
Tastes fine.
What's in a meal ready to eat?
I had chili con carne, and then I had steak and potato. Stew.
And the idea behind these is there's long shelf life on them, I guess.
Yeah, and the army guys be out in the field and they can eat them hot or cold.
Okay.
They're a wet pack, so you just put them in water and boil them
up.
Or you can just spoon them and eat them away.
Yeah.
They're designed also so they don't give you constipation. That's the main thing.
Oh, interesting.
So that's one the Euro camp, and you don't want to be getting the dose of the hits and mitts. So, So we went through a lot of the foods there the other day, and we're all commentating on which one is good. So there's a whole multitude of varieties you can get. You can get halal food if you want it in army rations, like, you know.
And where do you get the army rations? Where would you buy the stuff?
One of the boys brought a load of it back from the UK.
Okay.
And
is there anywhere here that you know of? Is there any good army supply stores that you get it in?
Yeah, you can get them in army supply stores.
Okay.
There's a very good one in Carlow. Now, I bought a load of grenade cans. They're great for storing stuff and they all stack and so grenade cans for ammunition boxes.
Okay.
So I bought a load of them and they bought in a pallet of them, about 100. And I went back a month later and I told everybody, I said, lads, 20 quid a pop. I went back and there's none left.
Gone.
So they were gone real quick.
Yeah, that's like telling a fella where your fishing spot is and the next minute
exactly
20 fellas
that's
turn
why
up
I
there.
I don't tell you where my bunker is.
Well, we'll get it out of you. I'm going to hack your brain, but at the end of this, know where this bunker is. He's not looking at me now. For anybody not watching, he's avoiding my contact. And tell me this. So, look, I think we're in an age, right, where a lot of people out there, they're consumerists, they're just take, they're spending on all these different handbags and shoes and, you know, and I'm guilty of it. Like, I love magic, still to this day, even though I don't do it as a profession anymore, but I love buying decks of cards. So there's a consumerist aspect to the world, I suppose, now, right? What do you think? Do you think most people listening to this, most people out there, should at least make an effort to just be curious about this world, you know, the outdoors and stuff like that? What do you think?
Just to think along the lines of what will I do for my family if something happens tomorrow?
Yeah. Okay.
That's it. You're sitting at home, something happens outside, electricity goes off, phone goes off, an EMP, say, or a
what's an EMP?
Electromagnetic pulse.
What would that do?
Or a CME, a coronal mass ejection. That's from the sun, and that happens every couple of hundred years.
Okay.
One happened there in the 1850s.
Right. And what does that do?
That would knock out all electronics.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely everything. Phones, TVs.
Is this a real thing now? This is
100% real. Carlink can invent, you can Google it.
Wow.
It happened back in the
day. So if this happens, it knocks out the whole grid. Gone.
The last time this happened, and it's called the Carlington event because there was a guy with a telescope and he watched the sun, he see the flares.
Yeah.
Because he could see it and he knew something was happening. He didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And what happened was the sun ejected a lot of plasma and coronal mass.
Yeah.
And Earth just happened to be right in the firing line. And it happens very regularly.
Mm.
We missed one only lately there where we were 6 days away from it because we were traveling about 25,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And this thing shot in front of us.
Okay.
And we came behind it.
Wow.
That was by 6 days. That was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
The Carlington event basically happened, I think it was around 1850s somewhere, where all they had was telegraph poles and Morse code.
Yeah.
All the telegraph poles started to go on fire, but the cables started to go on fire and the machines in the office went on fire. And they wondered, what's going on here? Like, they didn't have a clue.
Yeah,
nothing
yeah.
else is affected because there's no electronics.
Yeah.
But they said, if it happened today, we would be screwed.
And how long would it take to fix something like that? Like
a transformer, one of the big main transformers, they have a 2 year wait for them to get it, fix them yokes. We're talking a huge event here.
So if this happens,
we have space, we have satellites. Halfway between Earth and space, Earth and the sun.
Yeah.
Just for that. Just to
monitor.
When is the next one going to happen?
Okay.
It gives us 6 minutes to shut everything down.
Right.
That's it. That's the warning we have.
Yeah, yeah.
It is out there. You just need to look for it. That is...
Well, I suppose you see, if you think about a small event, right, because people find it hard to wrap their heads around something cataclysmic like that. And then it's like, what do you do, I suppose, if that happens?
There's no fix. There's no fix for
now,
that.
Now, some people might say out there...
There is a fix, but
yeah, cool.
It's the boxes I was telling you about, the grenade boxes, they're metal. Now, people use them as Faraday cages, which is a full metal box, and electricity just goes around them.
Yeah.
So they keep electronics, their phones or CB radios and all
those
that.
In
I
there.
Keep that kind of stuff in there as well.
Okay, and you keep that in there every day?
No, I'm not paranoid about it at all, but maybe I should be. But yeah, because I use stuff every day, and I don't want to be going open and closing in. Some people have trash bins, metal trash bins, and they have them lined with aluminium foil.
Yeah.
And then they have cardboard on the inside, and they have all of their stuff in there.
So here's the question, right? When does it become like prepping with, I suppose, intellect and planning versus prepping because of fear mongering?
Okay.
And there is, I suppose, a balance to be met there, isn't there?
When you see £1,000 a month going in your wages go to prepping equipment, then you know you have a problem.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Instead of buying the shoes and the runners and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and buying all the big equipment. I have all of the gear. Like, I don't need anything else. I hope.
Yeah.
Fire bunker.
Well, you've got a few of them that you can get into.
I can get my hands on them, but can I get there quick enough? Yes, I can.
That's ahead of everybody else.
I said it to somebody one day. He asked me what would happen if a meteorite landed. Say just say something like Chelyabinsk, the one that happened there a couple of years ago.
Mm.
It's on dash cams and stuff. It was a small 20-meter one.
Yeah,
that was small, but it kind of did a lot of damage and a lot of. A few people were killed, actually.
Mm.
But I was asked, what would happen if that was coming towards Ireland, say it was going to land in Dublin, or whatever. I said, if I'm driving over the new Rose Kennedy Bridge,
yeah,
heading towards Waterford, will I make it in time to get all my shite out of the attic? Was the question.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I? I don't know. You never know what's going to happen, what's going to come down the line. That's the whole part.
And in your world, your being the survivalist world and the prepping world, you must meet some crazies.
There's a few nutters out there.
Tell us about a few crazies without naming them. Don't name the crazies, but tell us about some of the crazies and what they do.
I can't tell you once. I have to tell you offline because I can't say it.
I'll go on.
No,
you can
I can't.
Indeed.
No, no,
you don't have to name any name. Like, okay, rename the names and rename the places, and then you can tell a story that we'll all know is true and we'll have no idea who it is or where it is.
I hope he's not listening.
But no, listen. No, it's Charlie and Monaghan. Let's call him Charlie and Monaghan. There you go. Off the top of my head. Charlie and Monaghan.
Charlie's friend, Paddy Joe.
Okay, Paddy Joe.
So Paddy Joe was out with us one day and he'd be dressed in a full boiler's uniform and he had a leather belt around his waist and he hanging a few knives off him.
Yeah.
That was scary. What he used to do at night, you'd hear the knives rattling. You're going around collecting metal and cans and anything you could recycle and put him into his van. And he didn't mingle at all. He'd stand in the dark. So you can imagine a really, really dark wood and a fire going and you just see a few of the lads around the circle. Next thing, you hear the metal rattling and there's a man standing in the corner. And this guy only kind of rocked up to one of our camps.
I was going to say, you didn't know him well.
We didn't know him at all.
Right.
No,
okay.
Some people,
you didn't know him at all.
They all see us going to the camps and I put up a notice on Facebook.
Yeah.
Our survivalist group on Facebook. And you'd see it create events and people just turn up from nowhere. Like,
okay.
You know,
so it's kind of like open to the public.
We got over 80 at one of the earlier ones. And
that's a lot, yeah.
It got tight on toilets and helping hygiene and all that kind of stuff. We had another one up.
Sorry,
in,
tell us, you're out in the woods. How do you go to the toilet in the woods?
Oh, yeah, shovel. Shovel in a hole.
Yeah.
We had over 100 at another one in Napin up in Mayo.
Okay.
And I know health safety came in and got us on that one because they came and they, because we were advertising for mental health after COVID or before COVID. And it was a huge thing and we were really proud to be doing it for mental health people, you know, because a lot of suicide with people out there and to get out and to meet people.
Yeah.
After and before COVID is when we're talking about. After COVID, to get out and actually meet people in an environment where you enjoyed and you don't have to be anybody. You can be whoever you want and sit around the fire, talk about whatever you want. And that was a great one up in Napin. And the health and safety stopped us because we couldn't cater for the masses of people that were coming to us.
Too many people. So let's talk for a moment. Let's imagine for a second. Okay, and this is just for fun. This is a fun, I like these kind of, experiments, right? Thought experiment. We'll call it a thought experiment, right? Let's imagine your freeze-dried food is gone. It just disappears, right? Yeah. Your bunkers are gone. Everything's gone, right? Now we're into real survival mode.
Proper
survival of the fittest, right? Mm-hmm. You've educated yourself in this world. Most people have not educated themselves in this world. Like, what are you doing first? Are you foraging? Are you fishing? Are you hunting? Like, what are you doing? For food, for survival, what are you looking for?
At that stage, it'll be foraging.
Okay.
Not necessarily out in the sticks, but you make your way into town. But a lone wolf, which is a person on his own, doesn't exactly get it. It's harder for them to do anything on his own.
Right.
So that's the benefit of a group, as a pack.
Yep.
So we kind of have a few plans out there in mind. If something like that did happen, we know where our meeting places are.
Yep. Okay.
And we know what our tactics are. You know, if the food runs out, we know where to get more.
Okay. And when you say we know where to get more, like, are you going to the forest foraging for mushrooms? Looking for?
No, we're going. Well, we're going to a certain place where we know there's a lot of food.
Okay.
Okay, and there's going to be a lot of stored food, and it's not in general public view.
Okay.
It's not a big supermarket or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's bigger.
Okay.
Just use your imagination.
Yeah.
So one of them places, a few people rock up, and we'll go and we'll... At that stage, I would expect everybody, half the people to be dead anyway.
Yeah.
And there'll only be a few zombies going around or something like that. please God, we don't ever get to that stage. But
no, but let's just go back to foraging. From obviously, are you do you forage?
I do, yeah, forage. Yeah.
What are safe things that people out there who are interested in this? If they're walking along their forest next weekend, or you know, or if they're just interested in like safe things that people can forage for that you know is like
something
nearly 100% safe.
You've probably seen every day of your life when you go fishing, and you're a keen fisherman.
Yeah.
So if you're in a lake, which I believe you are lately, and did you see the white stalks sticking out of the water? the reeds, the big reeds, the white big, and you touch them and they open up all over the place. If you can get the bulb of that reed,
okay, the root,
that is an actual potato.
Okay,
so you can eat that.
Right,
that is one of the old Indian methods of eating them.
And just so we're clear on this, educate yourself first with a professional before you go into a lake pulling this up and eating it.
Make sure there's no crocodiles.
Yes, yeah, so don't take our advice for it. But this is interesting stuff. Continue.
Yeah, you can eat them, but they're the same as a potato. So you boil them up, and they do give out the proteins that is required. Also, roots of various plants. Nettles are used by our forefathers, and they use all parts of the nettles.
Yeah.
The roots as well.
Dandelions. People don't know you can eat dandelions.
You can eat the whole of the dandelion.
Yeah, I've done it.
I thought it was pissing the bed, they call it.
Yeah.
Remember?
They're actually tasty.
Yeah, well, they're okay.
In flour, deep fried.
Yeah.
The only thing is you put them in vinegar. You have to put specifically dandelions as opposed to nettles. The insects don't have too far to hide.
Well, a young nettle.
Yeah, but in the dandelions, they look perfect. I washed them and then I just threw them in a bowl of water, a bit of vinegar.
Stop
Jesus, hundreds of things came up and out of them. I was like, where are these things coming from? So you have to make sure you steep them
properly.
What
did you do with them?
So a little bit of flour, salt and pepper, and then fried them on a pan with
some oil. So you would kill everything anyway, and it doesn't matter eating a few bugs.
Yeah, and but they were delicious.
A bit of protein there.
Yeah, a small bit of protein, but they were good to go.
Mushrooms it's one of the things I did years ago. I studied mushrooms, and as I was saying earlier to you, about 60 to 80% in Ireland are edible.
Yeah.
And 20% will kill you.
Yeah. You have to be careful with mushrooms.
There is mushrooms out there that will kill you. So being responsible and pick them from a field that has horses or cows in them.
Yeah. Because you know that they're most likely field mushrooms.
Them, they have to be, okay.
Yeah. And like the thing is, educate yourself in this stuff. So once a year I go on a foraging course. I mentioned it off air.
I might actually do one.
I go to the same place every year, Blackstairs Eco Trails. I have no affiliation with them. I pay in full. Hashtag this is not an ad. Like, do you know what I mean? But they're brilliant because you can do a foraging course or you can do a mushroom course, and they are experts, like proper experts. Yeah. So if you're going to learn about this stuff, like learn from the experts.
Might as well do it. Yeah.
And tell me, do you hunt?
I do. I have a gun at home still. Yeah, I have it. I'm brought for a walk for a while, but rabbits mostly. I don't shoot anything else that I won't eat. I ran over a pheasant, or a car in front of me ran over a pheasant here in Wicklow about 2 years ago, and he didn't squash it, so I just jumped out and grabbed it, and the pheasant's mate was up the road cock-a-doodling for whatever it does. What kind of sound does a pheasant make?
We'll say it's a cock-a-doodle, right?
Right.
Cock-a-doodle!
The pheasant anyway was in the back of the van. I had him hanging for a few days, and we ate him there a few days later, so that was lovely.
But did you eat any other roadkill? I've heard other people eating roadkill.
There was a deer killed on the road when I was passing by the other day, and 2 hours later I was coming back from the shop going camping again, and the deer was gone. So obviously somebody stopped, grabbed it.
Yeah.
Ideal for feeding to dogs and stuff, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Mince it up. But
I've seen Hugh Fernley Whittenstall one time. He did a program on roadkill. There's a group of people actually go out on weekends looking for roadkill, and they just smell it to see how long it's. But I think there's a huge danger in that, surely.
Yeah,
if you get that wrong, you're in trouble. Like, I mean,
I've heard of the guys eating various roadkill. Like a fox is absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
I wouldn't eat.
Have you tasted it?
No, I'm prudish. I ate a snake once.
Okay.
In Australia back in the day.
But it
tasted like chicken.
Everything seems to taste like chicken if you don't know what it tastes like.
Yeah. You can eat chicken. If you kill the chicken straight away, you can eat that raw. Like,
what? Get out of it.
You can eat the chicken raw.
No.
It's only when a chicken's processed after 2 days or so.
Right.
That's when it's dangerous because there's contaminants in the body. But you can eat a raw chicken. 100%.
I have to Google this afterwards. I'm not so sure about that one now. Eating a raw chicken.
You can eat raw meat as well if you wanted to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like my steak rare, very rare, so I'm close enough to it. And tell me this, what's the biggest misconception people have about survivalists?
Oh, okay. People often put me in the same category as a doomsday preppers. Doomsday. Something really weird is going to happen and get into my hole and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's absolutely millions of miles from where we are.
Right.
We do it purely in case of emergency. That's the thing. That's it. My long-term survival plan is, if something happened, one of the volcanoes down off the Canaries, if that, they're talking about that one going to fall into the water at some stage.
Right.
America could be in serious trouble, but we'd also get a nice belt of water coming
in. Okay.
So you could be talking inland from about a mile, but they've done the calculations and they reckon you could get maybe a quarter mile of a height of a tsunami. Now, I don't think so, but then I'm not a geologist, so I don't know. Yeah. That's another thing that could happen, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I all do it just for self-survival. And do you know what? I thought it was a great hobby, getting outdoors all the time.
I think there's a lot to be said, without going to any extremes about it, that people not only need to get into nature more, but just to learn a little bit about, oh, that's an edible plant there. Whether they eat it or not is another thing. But at least they know that down the line, if something happens, well, you know, they have a few little tools, a few little techniques that they get out into the forest and maybe have an attempt at surviving. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And something crossed my mind a few minutes ago. Water. Obviously, water is essential, right?
Yes.
Let's imagine you can't boil your water. Like, what's the best way to purify water?
Yeah, yeah. There's a good few ways of doing it. Filtering water is not too difficult to do if you know how to do it. So you get an empty 2 liter drink can, right? Cut off the bottom of it, and you can stuff it with stones, stuff it with charcoal, stuff it with grass.
Yeah.
And pour in the water, and you pour it into another container, so it cleans out most of the filaments and most of the dirt, whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
Then you boil that part. You can boil.
So it needs to be boiled.
You can boil water in a plastic bottle.
Okay.
It's doable. It's not nice.
Not
but
ideal.
It works.
Yeah.
But it'll clean out the water for you. You can also get water purification tablets,
mm-hmm.
and they're common in all of the army packs that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
They come as part of that.
And tell me this, because you obviously have camped all over Ireland. Like, are there places in Ireland where the water is pure and
absolutely
running pure?
And I can tell you one place there is River Hollow Nature Reserve down in County Wexford or on the Carlow border.
Okay.
He has his own well and he feeds the whole campsite. So it's an off-grid place. It's
what's the name of it?
River Hollow Nature Reserve.
River Hollow.
And that's some place if you want to bring the kids.
Yeah.
Because they've got all camping spots everywhere. You can light a fire.
Yeah.
They've got no proper toilets. They've got water from the well. People go out and just fill the water only. Bring it home and they make their tea with it.
Oh, okay.
They go out and they just get
so
the water.
So is that good?
It is fantastic. I nearly get it on the way home. And I give a plug to John there in River Hollow. And, you can bring your car right next to your tent if you want, or you can leave it in the car park and just go down. He charges minimum amount per night as well, you know. But it's someplace if you want to go for safe camping and just try it out.
Yeah.
Kind of doing a bit of rough on, try cooking food on the fire.
What does your wife think of all this?
She loves it. She goes out as well. She was giving out that she couldn't go the other day because she's a dog groomer and she homeboards dogs. So
I think you're lucky though. I think you're lucky having a wife that has similar interests, because like, listen, I love fishing and my wife is like, I'm not going fishing, Keith. That's your thing. You know, and I think it's rare that you would have a couple that are into the same, what some might see as an unusual hobby. But isn't it brilliant that you found a partner who actually embraces what you do?
Yeah, but the thing they say about fishing as well is, in a man's brain, like, your work is very busy life, right?
Yeah.
And your brain is flying around up there, you're thinking of everything. But over in the corner of your brain is a little box.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in that box. It's a square box, nothing in there. As soon as you get out your fishing rod, you're in that little box doing nothing. Everything else is gone. You're in that empty box.
Yeah.
That's what fishing is.
Oh, completely. Like, when I'm fishing, people say, what are you thinking of?
I'm
only thinking of one thing. Yeah. Where's the fish?
Where's the fish and how, like, I'm going to eat it?
Yeah, that's why I go fishing. Like, and so it's similar
for
you then.
I love going camping because the phones more or less get turned off because we're very little reception anyway.
Yeah.
But that's it. We turn off and we're just there listening to this. There's a big river runs beside us and you can hear that the whole time when you're there. You know, it's really soothing. And the wind blowing in the trees and the trees giving a bit of lean to and a few animals. There's a deer come in. We saw deer scat very close to my tent the other day, and I have seen deer in that area before, so you could be asleep. Like, when we were camping down in Kilorgan, a herd of deer came through we were on the ground using tarps just wrapped up as tents,
because
we didn't bring tents with us. So a herd of deer came and we knew there was a dead end where they were running to, and then they came back again.
Okay.
And we were there in really dark camouflage tents. And we're shitting ourselves. Amazing. Like, oh, good years, I'm going to be trampled to death by 20 of them or so, you know.
Brilliant, though.
Oh, yeah. But, that's what I love about
being outdoors. Do you camp during the winter?
Yes. Minus 15 was our best.
Okay, well, what's the extra tips for that then? I mean,
I can't drink the beer because it's too cold. Yeah, serious, Scott. We were there and
hot whiskeys.
We had to warm the beer up because they were gone cold, you know.
Right, yeah.
They were starting to freeze, you shake them, then they just completely.
But to stay warm during the winter when you're camping,
that's
like,
fine. Yeah, we have all the right kind of equipment. Mine is a minus 40 sleeping bag.
That's what I was going to say, special kind of sleeping bag.
Neoprene gloves, layers, and you wear layers is important when you're camping, especially work at height. We had two guys rock up one day and they brought a tent with them and everything, and they never, you know, set up down in the woods. in Glengarra, and a storm of all storms came in that night, lashed rain. Yeah. And sure, I was in a hammock sleeping and I was slightly tipsy. I couldn't get back into it. So I curled up around the fire.
Oh, yeah.
One of Lad's birthdays, a significant birthday. Curled up around the fire, and it was one of the best nights I ever slept in.
Yeah.
The two boys got up the next morning, and without saying anything to us, I said, "Jeez, lads, you look fair rough. You all right? We forgot our sleeping bags."
Oof.
And they slept in that tent without sleeping.
Frozen.
Bags. And they froze the whole night, yeah. No sleep. And I said, all you had to do is ask any of us, because we all carry double of everything.
Yeah.
We carry two of everything. I carry four sleeping bags.
Right.
This time, this weekend, I had two tents.
Okay.
Just in case there's an incident like that again.
A leak or whatever, yeah.
There's no harm throwing them into the car and leaving there. If we need them, they're there.
Yeah.
That's prepared.
Well, that's brilliant. So tell us, where can people learn more about what you do? What's your website? What's the Facebook group?
We have one Facebook group, or the website is irishsurvivalsandprepper.com.
Okay.
And Facebook is the main one, Irish Survivalist Group, and then Irish Survivalist and Prepper Group.
And do you still organise public events that people can go to?
We just did one the other day, only 2 days ago. So
brilliant.
Yeah, so we're trying to do more events, but sure, I'm exceptionally busy, like yourselves, and this time we're coming up to Christmas as well.
Yeah.
And I'm going off for some medical leave now shortly.
Okay.
We'll be out, I'd say, before Christmas. We always have a Christmas camp.
Right.
But we'll do that in River Hollow because it's that's a little bit safer because we can park the cars within close range.
Yeah.
We're only 10, 15 minutes from main town, whereas the Glengarra one is 40 minutes and it's up in the sticks.
Okay.
We did have an incident up there years ago where an ambulance was called. The ambulance couldn't get to us. So I managed to get stabilizer man and we brought him down to, where do we go? Care. Brought him to Care and we met the ambulance there. And he went off. He fell off a height and whacked his head on an empty stream.
And was he okay after the end?
Yeah. He'd be crossing the head. Like, so right. I always recognise. Ah, jeez, Tommy, how are you doing? Look at the head.
Well, he survived. And tell you, to finish off today, if listeners could take just one message from you about your mindset, about your lifestyle, what would that message be that you'd like to leave to the world today?
I was asked about stress. I don't actually suffer from stress. And I think I'm one of the lucky ones, and I think it's because of my mindset that I don't let things get in at me. But if it does, I'm prepared for just about anything. I like to think I'm prepared.
Yeah.
Mental health is a huge issue, as I was saying earlier, and if you can just get in the right frame of mind about everything,
yeah,
and if you learn that if something does happen, grand, if something doesn't happen, grand, and just keep going day to day, you know, I don't let anything get in at me, really.
How do you do that? Like, do you have a technique, or is it just natural?
I don't know. It just comes natural to me. I've never had any stress really in my life. I don't overstress about things. I like to think I have a good relationship with my wife.
Yeah. So do you? Sorry for interrupting, because you said you don't know where it comes from. I'm just exploring this real quick. Do you think it might come from the fact that if we rewind all the way back, 14, you started, like, basically being a survivalist, being a prepper, so if you're prepared for anything maybe that life might throw at you, you're kind of prepared mentally then for other things. Does that make sense?
And my background as well, the Navy, I think that also prepared me when I was young lad growing up and I was on my own overseas, you know, and seeing the rest of the world. That's part of what moulded me.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll agree with this. Anybody out there who's got kids who's listening to this and you're trying to cotton wool your kids, I used to always say to my kids, find the most dangerous tree and climb that tree.
Yes.
And if you can get up, you can get down. So I don't want to hear you screaming, "Dad, help me down."
Yeah, bored.
Well, if they get up a tree and they get stuck, I would always go, "You got up, you can get down."
I also say, if you brought your kids out camping, they'll bring their kids out camping.
Yeah.
And that is God's honest truth. I've seen it myself. I've seen young kids that we were out camping years ago and now they're bringing their own kids.
Yeah, brilliant.
And some of the grandkids are along as well.
Well, do you know what? You've inspired me. I've got a tent out. I've got all the equipment to go camp. We've camped a couple of times.
What's your oldest child?
17. Now, they've camped. We've brought them camping. But we haven't been in a couple of years. So my promise to myself is within the next 12 months, I don't know if I'll do it this side of Christmas. I'll wait till the spring next year, maybe when the sun comes back, I'll go camping. Listen, Frank, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us here on Open Mind.
Keith,
and one final time, the website is?
Irish Survivalist Group on Facebook and Irish Survivalist and Prepper Group.com.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Thanks, Kate.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow, rate and share wherever you get your podcasts. It helps others find the show and it means the world to us. Thanks for listening.